Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Denise Ferreira da Silva, author of Unpayable Debt, published this year by Sternberg Press. Dr. Ferreira da Silva, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Stentor. Very happy to be here.
So to start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
The answer will be very long, but I'll try to make it the shortest possible. I am originally from Brazil, from Rio de Janeiro. I was trained as a social scientist, though at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro, we had our social sciences training was very strong in the sense that we had several philosophy courses, psychology, economics, like you name it, it was covered. I grew up in a low-income neighborhood in a housing project, Brazilian style, and have been politically active for a long time since I was a teenager. So I was in the Liberation Theology Catholic Church, in the Communist Party, in my neighborhood association, in the Black Movement, in the Workers' Party. And I was trained in Brazil for my undergrad degree and then my master's. So the book, in a way, reflects that background, kind of in the same way as for the global idea of race. But in Unpayable Debt, I think the question is more directly posed to the Marxist project, right? To the political project. And it is what the question it seeks to formulate through all the unpacking I do in the book is one that has remained even, you know, after I moved to the US and did my PhD and start to explore more the philosophical side of things. It still stayed there, as primarily because with all the changes in the U.S. over the past 30 years, with all the losses we have suffered, and I'm thinking here about, you know, the welfare reform, the criminalization of immigration, and the crime bill, and then the laws of voting rights, and now the laws of Roe v. Wade. So all of those losses also... you know, even as I was writing the book for a while, I was also reflecting them with the same question, like what are the basis for our political discourse and practice, and why colonial subjugation and racial subjugation are not central, have not been central. So that's what the book tries to answer. I think it reflects, I think I have said that, it reflects, I was very well trained as a social scientist. So I was so well trained that I could learn to see the flaws of the whole enterprise. And I have had this really varied political engagement in different ways from different fronts. And I think that helped me also to appreciate some of the limitations. And growing up Black in Brazil and living as a Black person in the U.S. and the U.K. and now in Canada, I think it all comes together, in especially in the ways in which the book begins with, begins with what has already happened, even though it has not taken place.
Yeah, I like that you frame it as coming out of your training in the social sciences combined with your political background, because the book doesn't have that tone of like, hey, wait a minute, what are we actually doing here? When you talk about the existing social science approaches to things.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. I was going to move on to my next question, but if you had a...
No, so just move on. No, yes.
Okay.
Please do.
Okay. So my first question is about the title. So it's called Unpayable Debt. So what is this debt and why is it unpayable?
Unpayable debt is a debt that one carries, but it's not one's to pay. hence it's unpayable, but that is more to that. So the phrase unpayable debt itself, it was something that we used to shout in the protests in the streets of Brazil, but mostly of Rio de Janeiro when I was young, as we were protesting the International Monetary Fund, structural adjustment policies and impositions. So we used to say that the external debt of Brazil was unpayable. So that is my memory of that. And then when Paula Chakravarti and I were writing the introduction to the special issue of American Quarterly, the title of the special issue was Race, Empire, and the Crisis of the Subprime. The phrase came back to me immediately as, again, looking at the situation of the Black persons and families and Latinx persons and families who are blamed for a crisis that was caused by the fact that others were, profiting from their inability to pay their mortgages. So it was just as absurd as the foreign debt, that was so horrible for Brazil and Latin American countries back in the 1980s. So the unpayable debt, the book is all about it. Any answer for the question of what it is that I'll give you now will be much less and will be, very, very limited. But I'm not saying that so I want to give you an answer. I'll give you an answer. But I just want to preface it with that. So in addition to what I said, that an unpayable debt is a debt that one owns, but it's not one's to pay, with the phrase unpayable debt, I am trying to capture how the circumstances, in particular the maybe I shouldn't say circumstances, I should say the social conditions, or what Marx called the social conditions of subjugation, how they in fact, that's one of those that the question got lost. So let me rewind.
Okay.
That is it. It is really about showing how one can incur in a debt that is actually an effect of the fact that one has been constructed as a person who has some kind of deficit or defect, whether it's usually a moral defect, which is, the ways in which racial subjugation operates, right? It was how it operated in the case of the subprime, allowing that those who suffered the most were the ones to blame but for the crisis. And then they were the ones punished, because then when the business went away, the foreclosures came, those were the people who lost their jobs and lost their homes. So it is the unpayable debt is the little machine that keeps reproducing racial subjugation in that very particular way through the construction of the racially subaltern persons and groups as having a moral deficit, which then becomes the justification for their, you know, precarious economic, social situations. And then they're blamed for that, and it keeps going. I think another way of saying that is a debt that somebody owes somebody, and then it is translated into a deficit that then justifies, you know, more extraction, more expropriation. There must be a better way of answering the question, but it's really impossible because
I think that is
an image, right? I mean, it is just an image that allows me to say all kinds of things. But anyway, I gave it a try.
Yeah, and I think we'll get a more fleshed out understanding as we go through some more questions about the book. So one of the things that drew me to the book was that one of your main touch points is the work of Octavia Butler, and in particular, her novel Kindred. So can you talk about the significance of Kindred and how you connect it to the rest of what you're saying in the book?
So Kindred, I met, when did I read Kindred? I think I read the first novel by Octavia Butler that I read was Dawn, the first one in the Xenogenesis trilogy. And then immediately I'm a bit obsessed, so I should read the first novel. So I went and I got Kindred. And I was taking a course, I was in grad school, and I was taking a course on Black feminist writing. It was a directed study, so I included Butler. And then I read everything, right? And I kept reading the new books when they came out. And it was amazing because I was able to see that the figure of that woman, the main character, which in every book was the same, but she wasn't the same. And she stayed with me. And when I was teaching at the University of California, San Diego, I was an assistant professor, and I used to teach the theory course. And at some point, not very at the very beginning, but at some point, I started teaching Kindred as part of my theory of ethnic studies course. And then every time I was teaching it, it became more and more evident that there was something about space and time in that novel that was relevant towards making sense of racial subjugation, not only in the U.S., but beyond. And it's precisely, you know, the way in which slavery refuses to go away, even though, you know, historically it has gone away. But yet, at the same time, you can just scratch the surface, and it seems that you can see that whole juridic economic structure operating everywhere. And with Kindred, first for the introduction to the special issue of American Quarterly, it was just perfect that, you know, that what happens to the main character, Dana, it happens when she and her partner move into a new house in Los Angeles, and then all of a sudden she's whisked away to Maryland in the 19th century. And it was about the house. So, you know, so all of a sudden, and we were writing about the, you know, the crisis of the subprime. So all of a sudden the image of the house in Kindred basically took over, and to me it helped to account for how buying a house for, you know, undocumented migrants and Black folks in the U.S. was akin to just, you know, return to the condition, well, in the case of Black folks, the condition of slavery. But in the case of even documented and undocumented migrants, to a juridical condition which does not correspond to, you know, freedom and et cetera, et cetera. So yes, from opening that introduction with with Kindred talking about the house and the house in its economic and then its ethical and its historical and its, you know, different meanings attached to the house. That opened up the, you know, number one, I when I wrote about Kindred and Unpayable Debt for that introduction, I wrote much more than we use in the introduction. So what I did was, a few years later, I took that, what didn't go into the introduction, and I wrote an essay titled Unpayable Debt, in which I explored those different significations of the house and the home, but opening up already with the structure that became the structure of the book. So the book has these four different moments, and each one of those moments, even though I don't say it very explicitly in it, but each one of them corresponds to the symbolic, the economic, the juridic, you know, dimensions of social existence, which are also signified by house, like oikos. So economy comes from oikos, and anyway, so I'm not going to expand much on that. But yeah, so the significance of Kindred is precisely that house, that moving into that house, basically relocates that person, the character, to the place where, you know, it's back then and right now are indistinguishable. And that place, you know, is also something that it's signified by property. And then if you think about the significance of, you know, owning a house in the U.S., I think it also is also a key for understanding, you know, all the larger processes related to that. And that was a gift from Octavia Butler. Just, you know, tickled my thinking and inspired me to explore further what could be said about racial subjugation and colonial subjugation if we just begin with the house. And that's how the book also opens, right? With the past perfect and yeah. Anyway, okay, let me stop here. Maybe I'll go back to it later.
Yeah, you can bring that back in further questions as well. So the next thing I wanted to ask about is this kind of central concept that comes up over and over in the book of the wounded captive body in the scene of subjugation. And so I'd like if you could first explain what the wounded captive body in the scene of subjugation is, and then also maybe talk a bit about the fact that you don't have like an acronym or a shortened version of that phrase. You always use the full wounded captive body in the scene of subjugation whenever you refer to that idea. So if you could talk a bit about, you know, your choice of how to express that that concept.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like Unpayable Debt, the wounded captive body in the scene of subjugation is an image, but it's an image that it comes to you as you speak it, right? So I decided not to use an acronym precisely because I wanted to go, you know, to have that. I want to have that image in that the description of that image in the writing. I didn't think about the reader, to be honest. I thought about my writing. I didn't think what it would do with the reader, but I knew that every time I know that every time I repeat that, you know, that phrase in the book, I'm gathering, you know, and I'm calling attention to what to the scene, to the main scene, which is the one that in a way allows me to assemble the method for reading in that is on Payable Debt, right? Because on Payable Debt is a method for reading. And that scene is from Hortense Spiller's Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe. And the scene when she described the ungendered female flesh. So the wounded captive body in the scene of subjugation is also another name for the ungendered female flesh. And what that image does to me, for me, is to take, actually it allows me to avoid concepts that will be immediately read as something else and then be hijacked. And whatever I write, if I use the concept such as the concept of the slave, will be hijacked by all the meanings that the slave and slavery have, and what I'm trying to say, could be lost. So that the wounded captive body in the scene of subjugation allows me to bring captivity, which is slavery, to bring the body, the captive body, the body of the enslaved, and refer it to the black body, but without using blackness, which also as a social category also could hijack what I'm trying to say. When you read the book, you see that it also allows me to make a reference to the flesh, which has a very important role in Hortense Spiller's text and thinking, and also in the argument that I make in the book, and that primarily the propositions at the end of it. And the scene of subjugation is not the scene of racism, it's not the scene of exclusion, it's not the scene of discrimination, but it is the scene that shows racial subjugation as being primarily a juridic and economic process. So the reference to the scene of subjugation allows me to take the arguments made in the book outside of the usual sociological understanding of racial subjugation as exclusion, discrimination, etc., and allows me then to move with the argument that, the argument that we should look at the color line beyond, reference to skin color, but to look at the ways in which it is, it reproduces the juridic and economic investments of in slavery, related to slavery. So the phrase does quite a bit of work, even before it does any of it, because by the time I assemble it in chapter one, and I assembled it reading, Hortense Spiller, Saidiya Hartman, and Fred Moulton, it already maps all the argument in the book. I think there is a way. I mean, you can put all those words somewhere and make all the connections to different arguments I make in each chapter. Well, I think, I don't know what the readers will think.
Yeah. As a reader, I think that what you're saying there is pretty accurate to how the book leads you through your arguments there. Could you say a little more about your perspective on the way that conventionally social science talks about race, because that's one of the things you're critiquing, is the way that race gets used in sort of typical social science studies.
Yes. So this is an argument that I make in my first book, Toward the Global Idea of Race, which is I try to excavate the conditions of the conditions of emergence and the conditions of production of the concepts and categories that play out in racial subjugation at the concept, at the symbolic level, or at the level that others would call ideological or cultural. And finally, after 20 years almost, I figured a way of describing it in a shorter and I think easier way of describing it So In Toward the Global Idea of Race took me 350 pages now in the paper that it's shorter. And the way I describe this usual sociological explanation for racial subjugation, I call it the racial dialectic. And it has three moments. The one moment is a moment of attribution of the cause for, you know, discrimination and exclusion. It is attributed to physical traits, right? To racial difference. So Black people are discriminated against because we have some physical traits that identify us as Black. And then white people don't like those physical traits because in their mind they are actually signs of some mental and moral attributes which are not good. So they discriminate against us, against Black people. So that's the usual, that's the usual argument, the beginning. So, okay, that attribution actually places the cause of racial subjugation on the person who is subjugated or on the group that is subjugated. And that on the one hand, and then on the other hand, it also constructs the elements of racial subjugation as being signaling some kind of moral deficit. So you have physical difference that then leads to a morally improper attitude, which is to discriminate against somebody or some people on the basis of a belief on their own moral deficit. So that's the second moment of that racial dialectic. And then of course the result is that the reason for racial subjugation, you know, ends up being the racial difference that is born in those who are subjugated and not on the juridic, economic, symbolic and context within which it takes place. So in Toward the Global Idea of Race, I did the mapping that I say the mapping of the analytics of raciality, and in that I was primarily, you know, excavating what I call the political symbolic context of modern thinking, where racial difference and cultural difference play, they have been playing a crucial role since the second half of the 19th century. And then in a paper that task is already done, but then, so what I do is to, you know, trying to displace the racial dialectic as a, you know, as the explanation for racial subjugation. And I propose an explanation for racial subjugation, which is also an account of the relations between state capital over the past 200 years almost. But an explanation that actually is primarily what a mapping, or maybe not, I can call it a mapping, but maybe better is a description of the political architecture, of the liberal political architecture in the post-Enlightenment period. So in the previous book, I was able to identify the symbolic as a crucial moment of the political, and then also, more importantly, to show how racial difference and cultural difference are such important, you know, weapons in that arsenal. And then in this book, I just bring the symbolic to the analysis of the juridic, the economic, and the ethical. And that allows me, you know, the mapping of the political architecture of the global present. I think you can see it, right, how that's connected to my training, to that initial preoccupation. Because that's, you know, I'm still dealing with the same question, right? And I was already dealing with that question in Toward the Global Idea of Race, but I didn't have the vocabulary for making, you know, for doing the work of, which is more of a work of political theory than of sociological theory or, you know. which that's something I didn't say when I was talking about my background. So I did social sciences as an undergraduate, but my area of concentration was political theory. Even though I wasn't thinking of any of those questions back then, but I was absolutely fascinated by political theory, and I think I still am.
Yeah. So earlier on, you referenced Marx, and so one of the things you're doing in the book is developing a critique of some of Marx's ideas. So could you walk us through what you have to say about Marx?
Yes, two things, but those are two different positions about Marx. On the one hand, that is a reading of, do you want me to talk a lot about it? Because I can just...
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so the more general argument in regards to I'll call it historical materialism, is an attention, I give attention to a distinction Marx makes that is crucial for what has become, I think I would say, the destiny of colonial subjugation in Marxist theorizing, right? Which is, and the destiny is, you know, being placed as the moment of primitive accumulation, as the moment just before accumulation of capital proper takes place. And that's, I forgot his name. I was going to mention somebody. David Harvey, you know, even his accumulation by dispossession is actually described that moment happening, you know, now as still not a proper moment of accumulation of capital. So I, you know, so that first moment is one of the most general comment, I should say, is one that deals with these, in which I try to deal with this distinction by going back to Marx and then looking at how the position of slavery and the colonies in the building of his argument regarding, you know, the theory of value. And what I find is that I find two different moments in his presentation of the concept of capital. One moment, which is a moment of determination of capital, which is the moment of, you know, answering the question of what is capital, what is its intrinsic difference, and that moment, both the notion of time and labor time are crucial. And the other moment is the moment of distinguishes the the mode of capital as a mode of production from others, right? And the others are not determined. The one that is determined is capital. So I call that second moment in the presentation of capital one of delimitation, because there, instead of answering the question of what capital is or what capital is not, Marx, in particular, in regards to the colonies and slave labor and slavery, what Marx states is that these two are not capital, because they refer and they exemplify different social conditions, different social relations of production. But he doesn't determine them, and nor does he determine capital against them. So I call this moment of what I highlight in this moment of delimitation is precisely the fact that what we have there is an articulation of negation, is a mode of negation that is articulated through infinite judgments. And here I'm just quoting, using Immanuel Kant's table of categories. So that allows me to do several things. And that is where there is another distinction in there. One is, on the one hand, it allows me to agree, like, I agree with Marx, and I agree with his statement that labor, that living labor time, labor as applied, is the only productive factor, is the only productive factor, the only factor that produce value, more importantly, in that produce exchange value. And agreeing with Marx in that, and also assuming that actually there is no determination of slave labor, right? That slave labor, if you take his descriptions of labor, they could easily apply to slave labor. So slave labor doesn't count in the production of capital only because of the juridical conditions, which is, you know, title and not a contract. So I agree with Marx in that labor is the only productive factor there, in productive of exchange value. But then I disagree with him in that slave labor should not count because of those are different juridical conditions that, you know, they are outside of the historical time of capital. So in doing that, you know, in agreeing with him and taking away the delimitative separation that he creates, I can make an argument. I mean, I can make the argument. I can present the argument, because I'm presenting the argument, that slave labor entering the production of the commodity. And to do that, I use his description of the law of value as it is in Chapter 7, Volume 1 of Capital. And I can make the argument that slave labor does participate in the production of the value of the yarn. But of course, on the other hand, it is not counted because it's been delimited out. So that, let me go back to this. So slave labor entered in the production of the value of the yarn, but it's unlike wage labor. What enters in the production of the yarn is the total value produced by slave labor, and not only the value minus wage, right? So that is, and so what is in this, that means that what is being extracted from slave labor is total value, while what is extracted, extracted from living labor or wage labor, is surplus value, and that difference between total value and surplus value is the excess, which then I can take as an element, as part of the description of racial subjugation. So that's one of the things. It's so much, Stentor. I'm like, I can't do this. It's too much.
No, this is good. And this, you know, if people have more questions, right, then they can go read the book.
Yeah, okay. That's how you do it. Wow. Okay, I'm going to stop here. That's okay. It. You figure out how to make it work, okay?
Okay. So then I was also interested in the cover of the book. I always like to ask my interviewees about the cover images of their books. So yours is a drawing of a hand holding a match that's been drawn on this like textbook page that's kind of cut out of a larger image that you have reproduced within the book. Could you tell us a bit about, this image? How did you find this, and why did you choose this as your cover image?
This one is a short answer. the editor of the series with Sternberg, Ana Teixeira Pinto, she had some suggestions as, you know, to possible covers, and she really liked Raj Kamal Kalon. And then she sent me several images. And then when I saw this one, like, couldn't be better. that hand holding, you know, that little, you know, match and burning the pages of history. So I couldn't, yeah. I thought it was such a perfect image for, you know, for the content of the book. It is, you know, talking about Maryland and Virginia and then Washington, D.C. So I just thought, yeah. And then we had some discussions about how, you know, what to have in the cover, right? Because then there is only so much that it's shown in there. And the question was about, you know, where should the match be, and the debt or unpayable, and so different things. But yes, these lives I saw, and I thought that's it. That's the cover for my book.
Yeah. It's nice when a decision is easy like that. You see, I'm like, that's what it's got to be.
No, yeah, it was really amazing working with Anna and the editor, Max Bach at Sternberg, because so there was some, you know, so they had so much care with the thinking about the object as the book, not only about the text. So how, you know, how people would look at it, how it would be held, and then, you know, how the image would look on the page and the colors. So working with them on that part was really a pleasure, because we are also thinking about creating an object that it's, you know, pleasant and pretty.
Well, you can pass on my compliments, because this is like a nice book to hold. I'm glad I have the paper copy and not just a, you know, an ebook of this one.
Oh, thank you.
So, and then that provides a nice segue into one of the wrap-up questions, as, you know, don't want to keep you forever here, but I wanted to give you a chance to give like a shout out or a thank you to anyone whose help was important to you as you were writing the book.
Oh, wow. I have a whole bunch of people to thank for their help and support. One of them is obviously Mark Harris, who made life possible while I spent the pandemic year writing a book. But my friends, people with whom I have been thinking for a long time, they are the members of the Anti-Colonial Machine. They all know who they are, but I have to thank Fred Moulton and David Lloyd, because they did read you know, versions of this book. And also Hortense Spillers, just for her writing and thinking and her existing in this world and allowing me to think the things that I need to. And yeah, and then my students, yes, it would be a long, long, long list of thank yous. But the folks from the Anti-Colonial Machine and Practicing Refusal are folks with whom I have been, you know, talking about many of these ideas over the years. And many times they would just like, what are you talking about? So, but then at the same time, once I said why I was talking about those things, they were the ones who gave me the support. So no, yeah, it's been okay. Fun to think with them.
Okay. And then that brings us to our traditional final question, which is, what are you working on next? What kind of projects do you have coming up now that this book is out?
Well, I am finishing a book, which the manuscript is pretty much done, which is titled After It's All Said, which is a book on actually... It's been inspired by contemporary artists whose work confronts the colonial, racial, cis-hetero patriarchal matrix. But then it's also a critique of the very field of criticality and the aesthetics. So it's a fun book. It's been a fun book to write. I have, because I spend time thinking with art. And I am also working on a book. I don't know what it is, you know, what the title will be like, but it's a book on interiority or a book on subjectivity. Sometimes I think it's a book on Deleuze, and then other times I think that can't possibly be because I'm not a Deleuzean, but it may become a book on Gilles Deleuze. But I'm looking forward to working on it. I'm teaching 2 seminars next spring at the Department of Philosophy at the University of Paris 8. And one is on interiority, the other is on subjectivity, and the 2 of them together will give me the book. And then I think after teaching the seminars, I'll know the title.
All right. Well, we'll be looking out for those and maybe have you back on the podcast to talk about those books when they come out. So thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Stantor.
This has been a conversation with Denise Ferreira da Silva, author of Unpayable Debt, published this year by Sternberg Press.